Dr. Philip Calabrese is a former professor of mathematics and has long researched the science of the Urantia Book. His paper, The Coming Scientific Validation of the Urantia Book, is a comprehensive analysis of the papers, and specifically, Dr. Calabrese pointed to at least 48 examples of the Urantia Book either predicting or verifying information that previous to its publication in 1955 was simply not confirmed yet by science. Dr. Calabrese, through an intimate knowledge of statistics, calculated that no human being could have been correct in predicting the subject matter that we are about to discuss, and that the odds that the authors would have guessed correctly are astronomically high, so we'll talk about that. Take us back to that time.
I never came upon the Urantia Book until it was, I guess, the summer of 1970, and it was love at first sight.
Really?
Because I had had a religious experience the December before that, and so I had, I guess, been prepared to have it put in front of me, and I really devoured it in about 4.5 months when I had some time between class years, you know, in the summertime, had some time to read it. So I really knew nothing about the Urantia Book, or at least not, no one ever put it in front of me, or not that I knew about it. I wasn't connected with the Urantia community at all. And as I said, it was pretty much love at first sight, because I had been saying some of the things that I found in the Urantia Book, only much more clear.
Sure.
A lot clearer than I had tentatively formulated.
Was there any particular paper that really grabbed you? Was there any particular subject matter in the book that really grabbed you? I know Dr. Sadler and Meredith Sprunger, longtime promoter of the book who recently passed away, said that it was the apostles and the way that the book described the apostles' personalities sort of caused both gentlemen.
Yeah, I remember reading that too,
sure,
about Dr. Sadler. I guess the you know, the concept of the thought adjuster and the connection to God that we each have was something that, you know, was part of that religious experience, and so that was corroborated. And there were so many other things that what I did was I used Clyde Bedell's Concordex, which was the only search engine, so to speak, at the time, and followed up various concepts that were important to me, such as time and space and matter and energy and spirit and topics like that. And I wanted to see what the Urantia Book said about them. So I used the Concordex to really investigate each of those concepts until I, you know, from all parts of the book. And then, you know, I got an idea, well, this is what it says about that particular idea. And that gave me the vocabulary to some degree to go back and, then I read all part four, and then I went back and read the whole book, including part four. And so I was hitting it like, you know, several hours a day during the summertime, I can recall. And, well, it was just one paper after another that was so impressive. So,
growing up as a,
I can't really say it was one paper or the other that that did it. I know paper 42 has been always a very important one for me, that goes into energy and,
mind and matter,
force and mass and,
sure,
and things of that sort, which are pretty pretty relevant today, even though it's 67 years after it was published.
As a scientist, you know, reading the scope of the book and what it has to say about things that normally wouldn't be associated with anything that would be religious, but did you ever ask yourself, why are we being given this information?
Well, I mean, I think the Urantia book itself says pretty good why we're getting this information now. It says that the world is going through a transition, that, and we are, we've set off and left the safe harbors, and we're now on the high seas. We're going to be changing very quickly, and I think we're seeing that in a global level, especially in the economic area and in the communication area and in our technology. We're going to have to teach our people new skills. And so the Urantia book, I think, is here because we've come to pretty much an end to development that's progressive, and we need another upstep. We need another revelation, and I think the Urantia book is going to provide it. But things are slow. You know, we think of it in terms of one lifetime, whereas the world is moving at slower pace than that. Although, from a cultural point of view, right now we're moving very quickly. We've got new things happening so fast that we need to learn how to adapt to that.
In case you're joining us here on Candidly Speaking, Dr. Philip Calabrese, a noted researcher and mathematician, joining us on Urantia Radio. Let's go through some of in your 48 points. What gave you the idea to, aggregate all of these things? And certainly there's probably more than 1,000 statements in the Urantia book that are considered revelatory, but these 48 meant something to you. So explain how you came about and put this research project together.
Well, for years, people have been pointing out when something gets noted in the popular press or in scientific literature, how the Urantia book seems to have predated that revelation or that discovery. And so other people who maybe are skeptical say, yeah, of course, you're cherry picking, or what about all the things that are false that have been claimed by contemporary standards that aren't accepted. So since, I did do a lot of teaching of statistics, I decided to actually design a statistical test of the hypothesis that the Urantia book science could have been written with just human knowledge and published in 1955. And so it was a matter of trying to prove that this is not a book that could have been written by human beings, or at least very implausibly so. Well, how implausibly? In order to do that, I needed to come up with a way to measure how right or how wrong by contemporary standards the Urantia book is on certain topics. And, which topics to choose. Decided on was to look for all those things that science had changed its mind on or admittedly knew nothing about in 1955 or earlier, but had subsequently stated as now a new knowledge or reversed knowledge. And I focused on those that the Urantia book has made some statement about. So I first decided, well, what's the population going to be? It's going to be any statement made by science that is now reversed or was unknown. And I decided to simplify by saying if the odds were by looking at what was being written in scholarly places concerning each of these issues, and if the contemporary, present contemporary, that is, was less than one out of three in terms of who was right, who was agreeing with that in 1955, then I would include it. If it was just a 50-50 chance, then I would say, well, I don't. That's not going to be included because it's just like.
Yeah, I see what you mean.
Well, I decided I wanted to make it 2-1 against, so that you know it would be an actual reversal instead of just something that wasn't known and maybe somebody could guess right.
Well, you know, today, so, Phil, there's a word that gets bannered about called consensus. So I think what you're saying is that you looked at the consensus. What did the majority of the academic community, whatever sciences you were talking about, whether it's geography or history or biology or astronomy, what was the general consensus at the time that was being accepted by science? And in the Urantia
That's
book,
right?
Okay, and continue.
That's right. 2-1 or more in favor of some notion that was being stated. For instance, right now, you'd have to say the consensus was that the solar system was formed by a condensation of, cold matter that kept
aggregating,
getting more and more condensed and more dense until it initiated thermonuclear reactions and the sun was born. That's the way contemporary science still describes the start of the initiation of our solar system, and that then aggregation occurred. But there's some real problems with that. But the Urantia book says otherwise. And so that was one of the 48 that the Urantia book got wrong, supposedly. At least it was on the side of, they reversed their position, or they added a lot more to it, and the Urantia book is still contrary to it, so I guess I would have to put that one on the other side. Not every one of those 48 turned out to be in the Urantia book's favor, but so many, in fact, I think there were only about 12 of the 48 that went the other way. And I calculated that the probability of that happening by accident was about 1 in 50 million.
So let me just paraphrase that, because what you're basically saying is that of the 48 examples that you found where the Urantia book states unequivocally about a particular subject, 36 times they were correct, 12 times they weren't. Statistically, that's about a 1 in 150 millionth in one chance of being that accurate that many times, correct?
That's correct. And you know, you can think about this by imagining a single die, a six-sided die, and you give the Urantia book, and many of these cases were less than 2-1, or, you know, the Urantia book was much more in the minority than 2-1. But even at that simplification, if the Urantia book in a rolling of dies 48 times independently were to be right if a 5 or a 6 come up, and wrong if a 1, 2, 3, or 4 come up, you'd have to roll that die 48 times and get 5 or 6 all but 12 times, which is, easily calculated at about 1 in 50 million.
Another way to look at it is if you were to predict what the die was going to roll on 36 out of 48 times, that's pretty that's
yeah
that's
you a- would expect that it would be about 48 divided by 3 is 16, so you'd expect you to be right about 16 times and wrong about 32 times.
But it's the opposite.
Just the opposite. In fact, even more than the opposite. That's the reason why it comes out that way, that this is very, very unlikely. Now, you know, people could quarrel with, are these really independent items that you've chosen? And I attempted to only choose things that were independent of one another. you know, if it's in astronomy or if it's in geology or something, well, those are pretty independent. You know, and I tried to cover all of the science areas so that I wasn't, you know, just doing astronomy or a geology or something else.
In 1955, even though the Urantia book specifically narrates Pangaea and the continental drift, what was the scientific consensus of continental drift in 1955?
Well, it was not the consensus, even though it was a theory since the 1920s. The mechanism by which these continents would, quote, drift apart was unknown. And the suggested dynamics of the proponents, I'm not sure the fellow's name, I think Wagner.
Wagner's theory in what, 19...
Wagner.
Yes. 1930s.
Continental drift. He tried to offer mechanisms by which this would happen, and he came up with the wrong ones, which discredited the idea. And so the idea was definitely in a minority of less than 2 to 1 until the 1960s, about the 1965 period, about 10 years later, that plate tectonics all of a sudden became the contemporary accepted. Again, it usually takes a while before the resistance to new ideas is overcome by some event that seems to be, you know, the watershed event. And after that, people can no longer deny it.
Now, in 55, the Urantia book states specifically that 750 million years ago, the first breaks in the continent landmass began as the Great North and South cracking. Now, have our geologists been able to determine when continental drift began?
I think that what the Urantia book has is pretty consistent now. I can't, right off the top of my head, I don't recall, but they have nailed it as far as when those cracks began to appear, and that was also when life was established, because they used those inlets of water to establish life.
Right.
And that is also when, you know, we understand life, at least a large part of it was being becoming prolific.
I know it's not on your list, but I recall reading an article not many months ago about biologists discovering this very thing, that they suspect, even though the Urantia book has already declared it, that this is where life began, in the warm water shelter bays of some of the inland seas that had not as much depth, so there was more interaction chemically going on between the material in the water and the sun and solar radiation and all that. So even today, there still continues to be vindication. Do you ever run across any new discoveries and you say, well, wait a minute now? Because I know you're really familiar with the Urantia book.
There's always a new one, and I keep adding more to it. For instance, we just had a report that the red man, the Indian in North America,
the Amerinds,
were here in San Diego, no less, more like 130,000 years ago, not the 15,000 years that they have been saying for many decades. And again, this is not completely, it's sort of, it's been published, the data has been good, and so people who are still skeptical, scientists are still skeptical, but, you know, the Urantia book, in two places, says that the red man came over the Bering land bridge when it was up, and the last of the pure line came over 85,000 years ago.
That's the last of them, which means the process started much before that.
You know, they weren't riding horses. They were on foot. And so this was a migration that must have taken 10 or 20,000 years complete.
Yeah.
Because the last of them left in 85,000 years ago. So it doesn't surprise me that now they're finding these bones here that are they were able to date at 130,000 years ago. So the red man came here a lot earlier than what had been previously thought, according to this new data. And, of course, that corroborates what the Urantia book said, contrary to science. So that's another example. But I think that was actually one that I had chosen as being a contrary to. I think that was one that's just been flipped.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You're particularly fond of the fact that the Urantia book writers ignored the Piltdown Man theory, but they gave substance to the other parts of evolutionary theory. So expound on that, if you would, because they could have easily been fooled, right? At that point, Piltdown Man in 19 whenever was considered the missing link.
Yeah, until Ashley Montague, anthropologist, challenged the Piltdown Man fossil, and that was in the early 50s. It was something like over 500 scholarly papers had been written about, you know, Piltdown Man. There were two fossils, actually both fakes, found in the 1920s, about 5 years apart. And while some people were skeptical with the first one, when the second one was, quote, found, unquote, that convinced just about everybody that it was real. They didn't have a lot of fossils back in the time. So as they got more, Piltdown Man didn't seem to fit. And so it was put aside, and then finally it was challenged. And when they took a look at it, you wonder why anybody was fooled. Well, they kept it under wraps. It was... it was in a secret play. You know, it was hard to examine and for any length of time. But apparently it fooled just about everyone for all those years. And now the Urantia book, if it were written by a human being, well, it's probably 50 to 1 and that it would have been included as a one of the fossils back in the when it was written. Well, if that had been the case, it would have discredited the book. So I thought that that was particularly important. I mean, the Urantia book mentions about 5 or 6 other kinds of fossils and corroborates that they are, you know, real fossils. Java man, Neanderthal, Peking. So I thought that that showed that they knew something that we didn't. And they explicitly said, well, you know, you'll never find a missing link, which was what Piltdown Man was supposed to be, the missing link between the ape and the human, because for the simple reason that no such missing link ever existed. It goes that far in debunking the Piltdown Man without actually, you know, mentioning it.
Right.
And I thought that that was pretty convincing on one, you know, on that one thing that whoever wrote the book knew more than we did at the time and still do, because there's so much more that we're still discovering. And there's always a lot of resistance to new ideas, even when they're when there's great evidence for them, because somebody's ox is going to be gored.
Sure, somebody has to admit humility, you know.
Well, somebody not only has to be humble, but somebody is probably no longer going to be supported for their program.
Right.
Think of that.
Yeah.
I mean, in other words, most of this research that's being done is being supported by grants, universities, and things of that sort, and agencies like that. And when your theory has just been debunked or has taken a hit because of new evidence, there's a lot of resistance, because this is, we're talking about money and support for a program. We're not just talking about, professional embarrassment. So there's a lot of resistance to new information, and that goes for the Big Bang and the so-called background radiation evidence. It goes for
space expansion or universal expansion is another issue that is quite popular right now.
It goes for the Big Bang explosion idea, promoted by a theologian that would be thought pretty fanciful.
The Big Bang that it seems to me that science and astronomy is focused on is that the universe is 13.5 billion years, and of course that number keeps going up every year, because that's only as far as we can see. What do you think is the confusion? Do you think they're only looking at this local area of the universe, mainly the Milky Way, or maybe an aggregate?
Well, again, the Urantia book says what the confusion is. It says it's pretty clearly. It says that there are numerous factors of error that we are unaware of and not considering. And the most important one is that the outer space universes, which, by the way, the Urantia book predicted, and our scientists predicted the opposite up until, they were discovered and viewed in the 1990s. So that's one of the 48. But what they are saying is that these outer space universes are not just expanding outward flight from the point of the Big Bang in time and space, without time and space, but are really orbiting the central universe and the grand universe where we are, and in the opposite direction. So it's throwing off our calculations. And I did a paper on how much that would be, and it's not more than about a factor of two. So if there are numerous factors, that would be one of them. But mainly the evidence for the Big Bang is the interpretation of the red shift in frequencies of distant objects. And you get a red shift when an object is moving away, and a blue shift when it's moving toward you, in the frequency, or in the wavelength, that is, of the radiation that's coming. And we know these radiation characteristics of various elements, and so therefore we know where the lines should be, and when they're shifted, well, the interpretation is that means the object is moving away or toward us. And what they find is the further away an object is, that the greater the redshift. So that's the main reason why we, contemporary science, believes in the Big Bang, because they can take those numbers and go backwards in time, and they find that, well, it all starts at about 13.7 billion years ago. That's a problem because, the Earth is only 4.5 billion years. By the way, that's another example of the Urantia book prediction. 4.5 billion years ago, it hits it right on the button. That was not the only estimate in 1955. I think it was more like from anywhere from
1 billion
3
or
to
something.
12.
Oh, so, I see. Boy, that's a big spread.
Yeah. In other words, they get it exactly right.
Yeah.
But I've been trying to find a good reference to that, but I haven't been able to. That historical fact that the estimates were much greater.
Let me introduce you to those who might have just joined us. So we're talking with Dr. Philip Calabrese, researcher, your Rancho book reader, student, also the host of a study group in San Diego. And essentially what we're trying to establish here is that if you statistically have shown that the chances, and I think you said 1 in 25 million.
1 in 50 million.
1 in 50 million chance that of all the pre-knowledge of the Urantia book, to have so many of these statements turn out to be correct, even though the consensus at the time the book was published was clearly in the opposite direction, this sort of validates its authorship in a certain way. Another good example of that is dark matter. We've only recently just discovered dark matter what they call dark energy, which is black holes in space. But don't you think that at some point, somebody in the science community ought to say, wait a minute, how is it that this book got all this stuff right when we didn't even know?
Well, a few people have. A few people have said just that. But, they're basically ignored because, as I said, well, for one thing, you're talking about a book that maybe discredit somebody if they come out to aggressively for it, because, you know, there'll be people who will say, well, that's a religious text, and it's not so hard to imagine being put on a defense, even if you're, you make a statement like that. So I think there's a lot of reluctance. I remember that the discoverer of Pluto, the story was that he visited the Urantia Foundation in Chicago. They knew of him, and he knew of the Urantia book. But he did not want that fact to be publicized.
Because he felt it would discredit him?
Well, yeah. In other words, it would be an association that he'd have to explain instead of being something that other people would say, oh, my, I'm glad you mentioned this. you don't get that reaction from either religious conservatives or even liberals who think they're liberal. And you certainly don't get that reaction from scientists if you say, well, here's a book that, is probably superhumanly written and it has a lot of science that is of immense value to use.
One of the points is the cell proliferation and using cells, the inherent qualities that cells have to heal themselves. And we are just now discovering that very thing. How do we use what the body already has to heal itself of its many diseases? Now, far be it from me to say this, but if people had taken that subject matter seriously in the 30s and 40s, imagine how much farther we might be along in biology and DNA and other, forms of study that have to do with the human body and health.
They make suggestions for the direction we might want to look for controlling, they called it very dangerous diseases, and they're talking about self-proliferation, and they point out that there are certain chemicals that will shut down the injury repair mechanism when the cells are proliferating to repair the injury. But after the injury is repaired, the cells then stop proliferating. And the chemicals that do that, well, if we could learn about those chemicals, then maybe we could shut off the proliferation of cells, which is what cancer, what cancer's big part of cancer.
Sure.
Because the cancer, just keeps growing and growing and dividing, cells divide and divide. They don't know when to stop. So the genetics has been mutated or has been changed so that something's gone wrong. And the Urantia book says that there are chemicals that we could discover that shut down an injury repair process when it's time for when the injury has been repaired. And we need to find those chemicals. That's my understanding of it.
Yeah.
That will help in controlling many dangerous diseases. Well, I can't imagine a much more dangerous disease than cancer. So, yeah, if we had more honest assessment of these matters, but, scientists are human beings. They they like to think that they're completely objective, but when comes to their own project and what they've devoted their life to, you know, how many big bang proponents are interested in the fact that, well, you know, they found this evil axis in the background radiation. And now it's been confirmed. They thought, you know, maybe it was an anomaly of the data, but sure enough, there's some sort of an axis that is observable. And then recently they found that there's a statistically, again confirmed, a statistical difference between the amount of energy on one side of the plane perpendicular to that axis than there is on the other. Five or six, something significantly different. They could not just be by random differences. Well, you know, these are contrary to the Big Bang theory. The point is everything is supposed to be uniform in all directions because of the Big Bang. And but has anybody really pointed their telescope in plane perpendicular, or rather in the direction perpendicular to the Milky Way? No, they don't. They haven't found out whether or not they can find those outer space level galaxies in the direction away from the Milky Way plane, only toward the Milky Way plane, which is where, of course, you'll find them. So they haven't checked to see whether or not the cosmos is really the same in all directions. They're assuming that, and they basically use that as a way to estimate the total number of galaxies now. So instead of having them in the plane of the Milky Way, and they have them, they're imagining them in all directions, and that's the reason why now they're estimating there are even more outer space galaxies than the Urantia book says. Mm-hmm. The Urantia book says, well, you'll discover no less than 375 million star systems in the far reaches of outer space. And they said that in 1955, and we didn't discover them till 1990s. And that's a very, very good prediction, but, you know, not many scientists are willing to take the Urantia book seriously. Maybe when we discover that non-breather life in close proximity to our planet, which is another one of those predictions that the Urantia book makes. I have to think that planet is close enough for us to actually learn about. If it's not in our solar system, it has to be close by. Certainly be spectacular if we found something like that on a moon of Jupiter or Saturn.
Right.
That would be, I don't know, maybe that's what has to happen. But, of course, we're looking for life like we know it. I think that the non-breather world would have to, you know, they say they're completely different. Both the plant and the animal life are completely different. If there's really these meteor showers and they have to be protected from them, does that mean that life is underground?
Yeah.
Life has got to be under the surface in some way if they're being bombarded, because it says they need these protective areas or devices whenever they risk going out into, mm-hmm. you know, on the surface.
I want to read to you, Phil, a quote from your own writings. You write in your coming validation, quote, "The real reason I believe in the science of the Urantia book and the authenticity of the Urantia book as divine revelation to our world, because humanly improbable avoidance of error, and that the meandering convergence over the years of contemporary science to positions taken by your Urantia book authors." I think what you're saying is it's because more often than not, the Urantia book has been vindicated, and that tells you that whoever wrote the book, superhuman, angelic, midwayers, you still feel convicted that even more so today. You started reading the book in 71. You're absolutely 100% convinced that the Urantia book is authentic and it is a revelation?
Well, about as absolutely as I can be convinced of anything, yeah. I think that we keep getting more confirmation. For instance, the Sierra Nevadas, the age was said to be about 5 million to 8 million. Then all of a sudden, one day, they changed to something like 35 million or consists significantly more. And in fact, the Urantia book, in fact, has that number in it. So, yeah, I keep getting more confirmation that this really is a gift from higher order life. And we probably need it as much as we have ever needed it right now, considering the state of the world.
Do you sense that secularism is trying to stamp out? I mean, you read reports all the time. There was a Pew study report recently that said that more and more people are moving away from religion. Good thing, bad thing? I think it was even predicted in one of the final papers of the Urantia book that we would be going through this period. But what's going to turn things around, in your opinion? Just a total, I give up, my life doesn't have meaning? What's the sense that you get from the culture today in being open to something like the Urantia book? That's a kind of complicated question, but... You know, what needs to change?
Yeah, I'm as you were asking it, I was trying to formulate an answer and none came.
that happens with me often.
I wish I could have had a good an
what
answer
needs to
for
change?
That.
Well, yeah.
It's hard enough to get people to believe things that are pretty clear. We're not, as the Urantia book says, you know, logic isn't our strong point when it comes to, you know, it's how clear and convincing, you know, and simple the idea is. So it's got to be something fairly simple. Well, you know, the gospel of Jesus is pretty simple.
Yeah.
God is spiritual father, and we are spiritual brothers, and we ought to treat each other accordingly. It's hard for me. I think the churches are definitely losing membership, a lot of them, not all. And it's not clear to me what is going to be the turning point. It's really not. We seem to be going through a slow degradation period. At some point, we'll get religion, I guess, and start looking at the Urantia book with clearer eyes. But right now, the best we can do is to get the word out that there is such a book. And those people who have a little bit of an open mind can take a look at it and decide whether or not it's for them. But it does take, you know, an unusual person. Those people who are already, you know, happy with their religion or their church or their other association are not really interested in having themselves disturbed by this this big book. And those people who are secularist or agnostic or atheist or, you know, are certainly, they've thrown it all away, and they're not about to look at it seriously either. Something has to change. We have to get less stubborn in our beliefs, I guess.
A real pleasure to meet you. Big fan. Love your writings. You're a great writer. You've contributed, I think, a lot to the substantiation of the Urantia papers. Are there other people that you know of that are also doing work similar to yours?
Yes. I would point out two people who are first-class scientists and who are similarly involved with harmonizing or looking for ways to harmonize what the Urantia book says, or using the Urantia book to help their own ideas about the cosmos. Nigel Nunn and George Park, and I think there's an E at the end of Park. George has even written a book that's available online. And Nigel has, and these both of these people were at the Urantia Foundation Scientific Symposium in Chicago last year. And that material is available. You know, a lot of science was presented there.
Dr. Philip Calabrese joined me on Candidly Speaking.